morning. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue Tuesday, March 12th. And for those of you with eyesight good enough to see and wondering why I'm signaling with my pins, Girl Scouts are in the building today, and I'm wearing my Girl Scout pin from the last century. We have four public hearings this morning. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2949.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. So House Bill 2949 affects large counties. And so there's two sets of counties that are discussed in the bill, and what we have is that currently Department of Revenue has been kind enough to provide the current numbers. Currently, counties with populations of more than 340,000 or less than 570,000 exempt personal property structures, manufactured structures, that are valued less than 17,500. And so that's referring essentially to mobile homes and other types of small manufactured structures. And with counties with population of more than 570,000, there is a personal property exemption for manufactured structures, which means that those properties don't get taxed if they're worth less than approximately $35,000. And so the original bill gives the county the governing body the latitude to increase the value. So, for instance, that $35,000 that would be exempted from personal property taxes. And the Dash 1 has a similar effect, but the language is a little different, and that allows the governing body to set a partial property tax exemption if the property is valued above that $35,000.
Thank you. Representative Gorsuch.
Good morning. How are all of you today?
Thank you.
All righty. For the record, my name is Chris Gorsuch. I am the representative for House District 49, which has the small cities of East Multnomah County, as well as a portion of Gresham, and about that much of the city of Portland. So, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Findley and Marsh, members of the House Committee on Revenue, I am here today to speak to you about House Bill 2949. House Bill 2949 is the result of a town hall with the seniors living in Quail Hollow Retirement Manufactured Home Park in my district. They were expressing their concern at receiving tax bills on their homes that they had not expected, nor had they budgeted for it, and they'd never encountered that in the past. Speaking with Multnomah County Commissioner Lori Stegman, she has had similar discussions with constituents, and she represents the eastern portion of Multnomah County. One of these constituents has submitted testimony explaining the effects of an unexpected tax bill of more than $600. Linda McNerney goes on to say that she had saved money to pay for her funeral expenses, but unfortunately that money will now have to go to the tax bill. The reason we have so many of our seniors and people living on fixed incomes has much to do with the issue around the housing crisis. So manufactured homes have seen a very large increase in demand, and their assessed value has gone up, in some cases by double digits. Our policy hasn't kept up with these large increases because each change to the maximum amount exempted requires a new piece of legislation. As a result, we hear from a lot of people that have their household budgets devastated by unexpected increases. To be more flexible, our counterparts at Multnomah County are asking for the ability to increase the maximum exemption so that these values continue to, as these values continue to rise, they won't have to wait for the next legislative session to address the problem. We've worked with Commissioner Stegman, her staff, Justin Black, who is here with Multnomah County Government Relations, as well as their Division of Assessment, Taxation, and Recording to craft this particular legislative response, including the Dash One Amendment. The problem for many districts, and certainly my district is no exception, is that many of us have a large number of mobile home parks with people who are living in very minimal economic circumstances. And so this is a particularly relevant issue for my district, but I know it's a problem that we see in other parts of the state as well. So, not surprisingly, I urge you to pass this legislation in order to help a great deal of our constituents of modest means, and I can answer any questions, hopefully, that you may have. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Questions? Any questions?
All right.
Thank you for being here.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you. Have a great day, folks.
We have two other people signed up to testify. Justin Black, please.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Justin Black, Government Relations from Multnomah County. Representative Gorsuch did a great job of explaining the bill, so I won't go into too much detail, but I do want to talk about really kind of the scalpel we're trying to do here is, you know, Commissioner Stegman, who couldn't make it this morning because we have a board meeting, she apologizes, but I'm here in her stead. But she has constituents that, you know, they cross that $35,000 threshold of assessed value to $35,000 and $1, and all of a sudden see a tax bill for the entire $35,000. So what we're trying to get at with the Dash One Amendment is to be able to find a glide path up for people in manufactured homes so they're not receiving a gigantic tax bill when in previous years they've received nothing. So just trying to find that glide path. And our hope was is, you know, this is going to require some outreach to local districts and others as we go down this path. So we want to make sure that this isn't a must, this is a may, and this will let us kind of head down this path, engage stakeholders, and have a conversation about what the best way to do this is going forward. I should also say, my colleague Jonathan Schluter from Washington County wanted to express that Washington County is also in support of this. We are the two counties that are above this population threshold and are both looking for ways to make kind of this important piece of affordable housing continue to be affordable housing. And I will stop there. I will say, I know there is going to be, the next testifier is going to talk about the $10 assessment for manufactured homes. I think we are interested in finding a way to make sure that that $10 continues to be assessed and goes towards the programs that help support people in manufactured homes.
Questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
John Van Lanningham.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Vice Chairs, members of the committee, John Van Lanningham, Oregon Law Center / Lane County Legal Aid. I am that next person concerned about the $10 special assessment. This is kind of obscure, but there is a $10 special assessment collected with property taxes that supports the Manufactured Community Resource Center, what used to be called the Ombudsman for Manufactured Home Tenancies, and it's based at Oregon Housing Community Services. The tenants actually initiated this, the park tenants did in 1989 at $3. They wanted to tax themselves as a way to support education and training for park residents and landlords. And over the years, the residents have supported increases and the legislature has approved that. So it's now $10. It's collected with property taxes. So it's very easy. It's just added to their property tax bill once a year, $10 special assessment, it goes to MCRC. The trick here is that years ago, we agreed with the assessors when this special program allowing counties, there are five counties now that do this, exempt property tax, exempt manufactured homes below a certain low value. It's indexed, it's now $35,000 for Multnomah and Washington, $17,500 for Lane, Marion, and Clackamas, I think. So those five counties don't collect property taxes on, quote, low-value manufactured homes. And what the assessor said to us with our $10 was, we don't want to spend all the staff time and costs to collect a $10 bill. So we said, fine, we'll exempt those. You don't have to collect the $10 on those accounts. The problem with this bill is that it's tied. These two things are tied. Section 3 of the bill would, I think, exempt all of those that Multnomah County does under this new approach. I'm not opposed to their new approach. That's fine. I don't want to lose the $10. If they're going to collect the property tax on $1, fine, collect the $10 for the MCRC too. And I think there's an amendment needed to the dash one to make that clear. And I'll suggest that to Justin, and I just want to get that on the record. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you.
Actually, I do have a question.
Yes. Representative
John
Marsh.
Thank you, Chair. John is our resident expert on mobile home history. What's the story on counties that are less than 340,000 in population? Has there been discussion of allowing those counties to take this path as well? I mean, it's an option at the local level, but right now it's an option that's not available to counties less than 340,000.
So I don't know. So Chair Nathanson, Representative Marsh, let me look at the actual statute. I think it's, well, you're correct. The way it worked was that there's been a provision in tax law that allows counties to exempt from property taxes personal property below a certain value. Mm-hmm. And when the brand new representative from Lane County, Val Hoyle, was appointed to fill a vacancy, she proposed this idea. And as I recall, she surveyed the counties. And those five counties were the only ones interested in doing this. Because what you're doing is foregoing property tax revenue.
Sure, absolutely.
So, you know, it's not forcing counties to do this. It's sort of opting in. So at the time, only those five counties apparently indicated interest in foregoing the property tax revenue. There are other counties. Look, your county has lots of manufactured homes. Mm-hmm. Your county didn't seem to be interested in that and apparently felt like the revenue was worth the cost. It was explained as just an efficiency measure, that it was too expensive to collect property taxes on such low values.
Gotcha.
It was not a policy decision. It was an efficiency thing. And apparently only those five counties felt they would save money by doing that. Okay. Your county was not one. Can't tell you why.
Thank you for being here. There's no one else signed up to testify on House Bill 2949. I don't see anyone in the audience jumping up on this one. So I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2949. We'll now continue with the agenda in the order that it was printed. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2122. And Mr. Alanak, as you prepare to give the introduction for this bill, would you please address an issue that's arisen in some of the meeting materials I saw already submitted? There's an issue that's raised. Would you please clarify, does this bill impose a tax on groceries?
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So in starting reverse order, the bill does not impose a tax on groceries.
Thank you.
What the bill does do is define groceries for purposes of taxation. This is building on a ballot measure that happened from last year. There were questions around what groceries meant, and the intent of this bill is just to continue that conversation around a potential definition of groceries. What you have in the bill is a first attempt, if you will, at the definition. And this is for purposes of taxation. And the way the bill is currently drafted, groceries would be defined as raw food or processed food sold at retail establishments. The bill does specify that groceries does not mean prepared food. So it does, there's a distinction here, raw food, processed food, or prepared food. The first two being part of the definition and the third not. And part of that, this distinction was there are a couple of local governments who have meals taxes, and those are prepared foods. So it does, the bill does specify that the definition of groceries applies to any tax that is posed on or with respect to groceries, measured by sales or any other means of measurement for purposes of taxation, or imposed on any privilege related to groceries. The bill also, in the last part of it, identifies establishments that are considered grocery establishments and those that are not considered grocery establishments. And the bill would take effect on the 91st day following sine die.
Thank you. We have several people signed up to testify. First, I'd like to hear from Sean Miller. After that will be Tim Cowan and Wendy Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Sean Miller, I'm here today on behalf of the Northwest Grocery Association, and thanks for clarifying that we're not imposing a tax on groceries in the bill. But understand that the House Bill 2122, although we don't have an official position yet on the bill, you know, obviously open to having the discussion and making sure we clarify what we perceive to be what groceries and what are not groceries. And I think staff did a pretty good job of distinguishing between the raw food or processed food versus prepared food. I think that's always been kind of how we've always defined groceries. And if you look across the United States, there's many different definitions of groceries as it pertains to exemptions from sales tax and other various taxes around the United States. And so, you know, I think as for how you look at the definition, I think it's pretty consistent to how we have defined it when you look at the exemptions. I do want to point out a few other items to look at and to consider. I think others have looked at definitions from the federal SNAP benefit definition. If you just recently look at the city of Portland, who did enact a gross receipts tax, their exemption on groceries were SNAP eligible food products, and that's defined by federal law. And so, you know, those are essentially items that eligible food or food products for home consumption. A lot of the same definitions with processed foods versus prepared foods in that federal definition, even though it may be worded a little bit differently, it's fairly consistent. It does exempt, you know, pet foods, soaps, paper products, medicines, vitamins, grooming supplies, cosmetics. So they do go into a little bit broader. You know, as you go into one of our grocery stores, you can obviously buy a lot more than food. And so I think, you know, distinguishing that and looking at that SNAP definition is also a further use, and again was just recently used in the city of Portland. So with that, I think, you know, I'm happy to answer any specific questions and open to the conversation. I think we're more, you know, wondering, you know, if this bill were to pass, I think more of having the, you know, how is it going to be utilized in the further revenue discussion in this committee at the end as it pertains to groceries? Because, you know, as you know, we have an interest in keeping groceries, you know, at an affordable price for Argonians. And so, again, thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Miller. So help me understand, if I walk into a grocery store and there is coleslaw in a package with the dressing as a separate item, and then I go over to the deli and it's coleslaw and it's all mixed together and I can just eat it, where does that fall under this bill, to your understanding?
Okay. Chair Nathanson, Representative Ruschke, really it comes down to, you know, that prepared food versus, you know, raw food or processed food. And if you do go to the deli, and I will say that there probably could be a gray area there, but I think how we look at it in the deli section, you see the items that are meant to really go home and to be prepared. And so you'll have a dish of coleslaw, for instance, that they will put in a container that you take home. versus items that are, you know, heated or, you know, cold items, different things that may be really used to eat and prepared on site. And so I think, you know, we try to differentiate between those items in the store, but again, you know, you could also, you know, for us, it's a difficult question, but I think from our standpoint, what is being prepared versus that prepackaged food or meant to go home with you to be, you know, yeah, prepared for dinner. Those are the items that we're trying to differentiate.
And just a quick follow up, and I apologize for giving you the hard coleslaw yeah question this yeah early in the morning.
Coleslaw. Yeah.
Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Sean. So I have more of a comment. I think I like the idea of using the SNAP definition. I think that's because I think, as we know, it's the more we can be consistent, the better. I think that's useful. I think it would also be useful in our deliberations if we looked at what other states did. I grew up in a state that had sales tax, but we exempted food, and I worked at a grocery store for 3 years. So I'm very used to, like, the, and you got to know the difference between the package of mac and cheese that came from the deli versus the box of mac and cheese, and what was food stamp eligible and what wasn't. And therefore, also, it was pretty closely aligned with what there is sales tax on, because where I grew up, there was sales tax on prepared food, but not on cold food. And I know that recently, again, going back to the federal thing as a good idea, I know there was recently a decision about pizzas, about prepared pizzas, that it didn't used to be food stamp eligible, but it is now. So if you get a pizza from a take and bake place, I won't do any name brand promotions, but a take and bake pizza, because you make it at home, even though it's packaged but not prepared, I think is the deal, that I believe now that is food stamp eligible. So again, I think there are some really strong guidelines in place that we can and should use on this. And I would say some combination of the food stamp guidelines and looking at what, say, Washington, California do, other sales tax states, to use that as our guideline would be helpful.
Other questions? Yes, Representative.
I have a question. And that's the bad thing about this is a committee bill, but what's broken that we need to fix? I don't understand what that is. I mean, what is currently wrong with the way we do stuff that we need to have this bill to fix? And I can't figure that one out.
I could make a guess.
Sure. You want to go back to the coleslaw question? Or?
Now, doesn't it? Yeah.
That's a good question. I think I think the only use for a bill like this is if in the broader revenue discussion, if something were to pass and we're trying to differentiate groceries like other states. I think that's the only, I guess, need for a bill like this or use for a bill like this in that discussion. But you're right, on its own, without any other gross receipts tax or any other tax proposal, sales tax, other tax proposals, there's no need for the bill. You're right.
If I may, Madam Chair and Representative Finley and Mr. Miller as well, I would theorize that as someone who is involved with the Measure 103 campaign on the ballot explanation committee, we had a lot of conversation about what is the definition of groceries, the largest concern being the way it was drafted in that, because it talked about for human consumption. We had some pretty vigorous discussion about, for example, vaping products. There is a good way to say that those are for human consumption. And so if that is just your definition of groceries, then you might inadvertently avoid from any future taxation something that you might that you could also make a good argument for. So I think the idea was that after going through that from a ballot measure definition of groceries, there was an assumption that perhaps we should have some legislative conversation and debate for going forward about, you know, with kind of back and forth and reviewing other things so that we could figure that out and make the policy decision about how we believe that groceries should be defined for the future, for any future use.
Quick follow up, as I recall, in our list of outstanding measures, vaping products are listed on that for further discussion. So I don't disagree, but so I'm just trying to figure
that's
out what's broken.
That's where it came from, though, I think, yeah.
And with the water, I don't think we have any argument on whether vaping is a, you know, inhalant versus yes. consumption. I think that's an argument that could be made, but yeah, I don't think there's an argument that that's not groceries from
clearly,
our side.
Yes.
Probably like to go back to coleslaw.
Thank you. Follow.
Chair and committee members, for the record, my name is Tim Cowan. The reason for my testimony is I looked at section 1, B and small b, where it talks about measured by sales, including gross receipts. And it doesn't say anything about, you know, statute, how that's all going to happen. The article or the testimony I gave you, I didn't know the process at the time. I put that information together and hand-delivered it to every legislator. I did not receive a response. I then had the East Galleria twice, and I didn't have a response. I've testified twice, and I've never received a response. So I don't have an opinion until these questions are answered. May I?
This is your time to testify.
Okay. One, what is the state trying to achieve by implementing a sales tax? Is the additional tax revenue necessary to meet current and or future needs? Are the current or new requirements discretionary? Two, what effect efforts have been made to control or reduce revenue requirements? Are the new requirements for funding necessary or merely a lack of establishing priorities? How will the voters be assured these additional funds won't postpone the need to address expenditures? Three, is there any efficiency that can be achieved with the arrival of new revenues? Does this new revenue reduce state government's need to be accountable for expenditures? Four, how much of the future needs for funding are a result of new requirements placed on existing programs? An example would be additional requirements placed on a public education system. Five, does a sales tax only reflect the state's lack of accountability, lack of commitment, and or capacity to create solutions? How will voters be convinced the state will be held accountable if they can merely increase revenue to make up for the lack of commitment to the best decisions for all parties? Seven, what options are available to increase revenue other than the sales tax? Is a sales tax preferred because it gives the state an immediate, where did I go? immediate boost in revenue. The next item would be, excuse me, does doing the gross sales receipt allow the state to change revenue without having to put together a amendment? Voters in the past have voted against the amendment or having a sales tax. So I'll let you read the rest of it. So here's my other question. If we have this type of statute, is there any adjustment to offset other fees? Right now, the state of Oregon has 12% of their revenue associated coming from fees. Is there any adjustment that's going to be made? Now, I do have a statement for you, if I may. If we're looking for revenue, I have asked this in the past, take a look at accounts receivable. Have the Department of Revenue come up with a receivable aging take a look at that because it should give you cash flow estimates. I think you can generate more money by doing it that way. The reason for that, for every 3 days that are delayed in receipt of accounts, you lose 1% of revenue permanently because there's 100 three-day periods in a year. That would be my first suggestion to go generate more revenue. The reason why I testified on this is because when you look at new revenue sources, I think that might come up as part of the discussions. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sir, have you had an opportunity to actually research accounts receivable within the Department of Revenue and what's available and what's not?
I have requested that, and I have not been provided that. I sent a list of questions to Senator Winters, and I also have provided that to the Department of Revenue. I testified at the, I believe it was the Joint Committee on Audits. And what I asked for there was if the auditors are going to come in and write up a review of the Department of Revenue, then what I would like to see is the auditors also come up with recommendations on accounts receivable and collecting those. We don't know right now what the aging is.
Actually, Madam Chair, that's not correct. So what I would share with you, sir, is definitely appreciate the good idea. Representative Gomberg has been,
yes, sir,
exercising strong leadership in the collection of receivables throughout the state of Oregon, including with the Department of Revenue. And just so the public understands, the vast majority of receivables within the state of Oregon are uncollectible. And so while the amount may be extraordinarily high, its collectability is very low. And so in terms of relying on it as a positive cash flow instrument for us is a limited tool. So thank you.
Any other questions? Ms. Johnson.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Finley, Vice Chair Marsh. My name is Wendy Johnson. I'm here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. The League opposes House Bill 2122 because it would be effectively a preemption on local governments. These definitions apply both to the state and to the locals. We have a couple of communities that already have a prepared food tax. Ashland's had one. And I'm not sure, maybe Marsh can help me. I think it was passed in 1990 and started in 1993. It was renewed in 2009, and this was done by the voters there. It expires in 2030. And then the city of Yahats also has a prepared food and beverage tax. It's also 5%. These were important community decisions, and they carefully defined what constitutes prepared food. And they got into some details on bakeries and pizzas and ice cream scooping and those types of things because these are tourist communities. And so those definitions really did matter to that community. So our first point is that we don't think we need a tax that's on the locals. If you would take out, if you're going to use this as a state tax for a definition for state taxes on the listed types of taxes, that would make sense. But we would ask that you not preempt the locals on our tax. Not very many communities have passed them. It's a difficult decision. And when they do it, they are doing it very narrowly to meet their budget obligations to their community and may choose to widen or narrow the scope. So for that reason, we would oppose it. We think it is a local choice. And then, if you'll indulge me, I would like to talk about some of the definitions should you go into that in future work. I'm kind of a tax nerd of wanting to figure out all the parts here, as you know. So the way I read it, there are many parts. The first part is it's got to be food, and that has to do with nutrition. So we're going to be fighting about what that means. And so, you know, you've added gum for sure, but are there going to be debates on what is nutritional value? There's no definition there. Where I grew up in a sales tax state of Iowa, and I remember candy was taxed, but some other stuff wasn't. So what is nutritional value? That's going to be your first hurdle. The second is so it's got to be nutrition. Second, it's got to be raw or processed. Neither are defined in this bill. And as you know from the food processing bill, processing is a really a term of art as well. So you're going to have to really clarify that. Then it has to be not prepared. And again, prepared is not defined. Then it's got to be sold at a retail, let me get the words right, retail grocery establishment. And you've listed those, and then you've listed those that are not retail establishments. A couple that really took me by surprise was the in 3A, so it'd be on line 24 and 25 of the first page. It seems to be talking about establishments that are bakeries, and so it's made a clear line of those are not, those are retail grocery establishments. In some communities, those bakeries are very much serving stuff to go out the door and be eaten right then, and so you're not making a distinction, and you're going to be they're going to be folks that are going to want to make sure they're in one bucket or the other based just on what category of establishment. The same thing is for what's not a retail establishment is the snack bar. I don't know what a snack bar is, but if I'm a snack bar, I'm not going to be groceries. But if I'm a bakery, I am groceries. And so all these distinctions of which type of establishment you are really important. And then lastly, so you've got the food, raw process, not prepared, and retail establishment. And then you also have to know what type of tax this definition applies. So that's in lines 14 through 18, that the definition applies to sales tax, grocery receipts, and any privilege related to groceries. That's the phrase that I don't know what that means, of what type of taxes are those. I know on in Measure 103, we were concerned about, does this apply to gas taxes? Does this apply to, you know, the VAT, the CAD, all the different types? So just knowing what this definition applies to, I think, is really critical. And then subsequent law, I think this goes to some of the comments made earlier. If you're going to do a grocery receipts tax, a VAT, or a CAD, or whatever it is, it would make sense to create the definitions for that tax rather than try to create a standalone definition that isn't addressing the nuances of that particular tax. And again, I would reiterate that applies to locals too. When a local jurisdiction decides to do a tax, we need to fit the definitions for that tax. Trying to have a definition doesn't really work in that case. At the Law Commission, we did create lots of definitions as starting points, but they were to be used as a toolbox. They weren't preemptive. So if you had a definition bill that did not have sub 2, for example, that said how these which taxes apply, that would be helpful. So you'd have a definition ready to go, but that you wouldn't have said what it has to apply to would be particularly helpful, because then you can add and subtract. I'm thinking of the public body definitions that are in the statutes. When the drafters now are writing a bill for someone, they'll say, okay, which public bodies do you want it to apply to? And you can grab that toolbox definition, but then you can take out who you need to or add in, so you have a starting place so you don't forget someone. That would work for groceries if you just had the definitions, but not what it applies to. So for those reasons, we oppose the bill, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you both for being here. There's no one else signed up to testify. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2122.
I was going to ask to have something, but I can.
Representative Marsh, before I open the next public hearing, do you have a question?
Yes, Chris.
Committee staff.
I'm wondering, follow up to those comments. I read this as defining a discrete area of groceries, and I don't see a conflict in local food and beverage taxes, which define a different discrete area of taxation in terms of prepared food. Do you see anything in this that I'm overlooking that would get in the way of local communities that are establishing prepared food and beverage ordinances?
I don't think so, but following up on some of the comments here, I have some other ideas on where to dig to confirm that.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you for the response. Mm-hmm. We will be moving now to the final two public hearings of the morning. I'm opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 80A.
Is
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Senate Bill 80A allows property tax statements and related correspondence to be delivered via methods other than traditional mail, for example, via email. It requires the Department of Revenue to notify owners of timber harvested from small tract forest land that a severance tax return is needed, and it makes that tax return available to the owner by mail unless an alternative method of notification is requested by the owner in that case.
Thank you. Signed up to testify is Mark Garst.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Mark Garst with the Department of Revenue. Senate Bill 80 comes to you at the request of the governor on behalf of the Department of Revenue. This is a mailing requirements cleanup bill that the department is bringing for your consideration. There are certain mailing requirements in statute that are inconsistent or outdated, and so that's the thing that kind of binds the three issues that we have here in the bill. County tax statements are required to be mailed or delivered according to the statutes, but then there are other places in the statutes where it says that the tax return would be mailed. So we just want to go through, clean up, and show that those returns can be mailed or delivered. And so that's the cleanup around tax statements. Right now, there's just a couple counties that are starting to email statements, but we know that some other counties are starting to move in that direction. And generally what it is the taxpayer will sign up. They'd rather receive electronic statement than paper. The second issue that it deals with is our oil and gas production tax program. This is a small program at the Department of Revenue. The statutes are a little odd. It requires registered or certified mail, which is inconsistent with the way that any other notices go out from the department. They're typically just first-class mail. We believe that all the taxpayers in this program are currently doing online filing. And so again, we would just want to change the statutes to say that notices might be mailed or otherwise delivered and allow us to email folks who have signed up for our online filing. Last item is the forest tax programs. The Western and Eastern Small Tract Forest Land Severance Tax Program has a requirement that the Department of Revenue mail return to taxpayers. This is out of step with current technology. We now have Revenue Online, our new Gentax system, and we're trying to move people into doing some online filing. These changes would not require electronic filing for any of our forest taxpayers. And additionally, we worked on, you'll notice that we're now on the 80A, so the A engrossed version of this bill. We worked with the Small Woodlands Association to make it clear that folks will still receive a mailed notice that they have a liability at the very least. So that is what the amendment reflects. That's the long and the short of it. So just a cleanup bill for the Department of Revenue.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you. All right. I'm trying to make eye contact. And it appears that no one else wants to testify on this bill. Thank you for confirming that. I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 80A. I'm opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 81.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, this Senate Bill 81 also has to do with timber taxes, and this essentially current statute has that timber tax deadlines are on January 31st, and what this says is for individuals that rarely cut or harvest trees or have a small amount, their timber tax deadline would be moved to April 15th to align with the sort of normal tax season. And the sort of rationale is that evidently a lot of these people, they might only harvest like once in a lifetime or twice in a lifetime, and so they're not necessarily aware of the January deadline. For those who file more frequently and have a larger tax liability for timber, the final payment date remains the same.
Thank you. signed up to testify, Mark Garst.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, again, Mark Garst with the Department of Revenue. Senate Bill 81, also at the request of the governor on behalf of the Department of Revenue. This is a Department of Revenue concept to move the timber return due date to April 15th. I think it was summarized well by Jamie. Currently, you're required to file by January 31st, and that's also the date for the final payment. This applies to the forest products harvest tax, as well as the Western and Eastern Oregon small tract severance taxes. It creates some complications. Harvesting can continue up till December 31st. We have taxpayers waiting on scale reports from the mill. They maybe are only going to have a couple weeks to actually get that filing done by January 31st. Also, as Jamie noted, a lot of these taxpayers, they may only harvest once in a lifetime, and they are just not thinking about paying their severance tax at January 31st. They're thinking more April 15th, your typical income tax filing deadline. And so rather than have to correspond with these folks, assess them penalties, we think it just makes more sense to move out the filing date to April 15th and just when people are thinking a little bit more about taxes. As Jamie noted, we have some of our taxpayers who pay with the return, and so that would that return due date would be the payment date for those folks. But for our quarterly filers, who are folks that have more than $1,500 worth of liability, they'll still do regular quarterly filing, which means that their final payment will still be due on January 31st. And that's consistent with the way that a lot of corporate tax programs work. So we've worked with the assessors, Department of Forestry, Small Woodlands Association, and private tax practitioners. And I think this is just a good concept all the way around.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you for the testimony. No one else is requesting to testify this morning on this bill. I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 81. There is no other business before the committee this morning. We are adjourned.